When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Daniel Paris, host of New Books in Finance, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm delighted today to have as my guest John Quiggin, author of Economics in Two Lessons, Why Markets Work So Well and Why They Can Fail So Badly. The book was just published by Princeton University Press. Professor Quiggin is a senior fellow in economics at the University of Queensland in Australia. John, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You know, your work is, I think, of tremendous interest to a lot of people who are affected by the economic debates in the United States and globally, but specifically in the United States. And the, one of the key things, I'm sure this is intentional, is you mentioned throughout the book that you have plenty of mathematical, heavy mathematically driven works available. But this is a non-quant account of more than a century of key arguments and structures about economics. And I was really very pleased and thought it was very digestible even for non-economists. But in effect, it is a work of macroeconomics. And so I applaud you in doing that and in a non-mechanical, non-quantitative way, explaining some of the key issues and disputes in economics that are playing out every day, certainly in the United States, in the UK, in Europe, in Australia as well, and more locally, perhaps in DC, on CNBC, and the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. And so just to frame the exercise, you know, there is this assertion in the US, which has been dominant for decades, and you're pushing against it, which is great, about that there's a market solution for every problem. And you're pointing out that just isn't so, and that the history of the market solution for every problem debate, that there is a long history. And as you say, it's framed in either an economics in one lesson or an economics in two lessons. Could you maybe start off by just explaining the meaning of your title and the history of that title?
Sure. Well, it's a response to a book called Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt, who was writing in the mid-20th century, or from the 20s, I guess, to relatively recently. And he basically, in turn, was drawing on great French economist Bastiat. And so his crucial point really
from
was...
from the mid-19th century.
That's right, yes. His crucial point really was... summed up in the idea that there's no such thing as a free lunch, that even when some kind of government intervention seems to provide something for nothing, there's a hidden cost somewhere. So that point is sort of made in various ways through his book, and that book's been written in the 1940s, been on sale ever since, and I'd written a previous book called Zombie Economics, looking at various things I thought were wrong with contemporary economics, and Princeton suggested that a response to this book would be something really good to do, and I decided Economics in Two Lessons. Not that what Hazlitt says is wrong, but that it's incomplete, and that the logic he describes works, but it doesn't always work in the way that he suggests it does. Frequently, if we're going to have markets working, we need government backing to make them work.
Now, you frame this debate, which is the entire book, about really how markets work, and then externalities and so forth that make them work less well, and policy options that can be involved as well. But you do so throughout with what an interesting tool that allows you to measure pretty much every element of this and this opportunity cost. So you explain both the market approach with a clear understanding of opportunity cost, and then how the markets don't work because opportunity costs become distorted. And I thought that was a very, for non-economists, a very simple and consistent way to measure the one system versus, as it were, the purported other system. Could you go over opportunity costs and how they can be used almost, I won't call it as a universal measure, but in this case, it is the constant measure of the success or failure of these approaches to economic systems.
That's right. Well, opportunity cost is, opportunity cost of anything is what you have to give up to get that thing. And that opportunity cost arises inside markets and outside markets. If I choose to watch TV, that's time I can't spend reading a book, for example, in a very simple version of that story. So it is, in important respects, a universal concept. It cuts very much against the idea, which is popularized with some non-economists, that economics is all about money. I mean, money, as I described, money and money prices reflect opportunity costs only under special circumstances. When we have world-working competitive markets, you can indeed look at the price of something and say, well, that price is the opportunity cost both for me and for society. If I consume this, good. I can't. That's money I can't spend on something else. Meanwhile, if society produces the good, the resources used to produce that good can't be used for some other purpose. And in a competitive market, those two things match up, and that's the marvel of the market, which I like to think I actually bring out better, I think, than Hazlitt, precisely because I stress the conditions and the limits under which this works.
Right. So prices are, you know, the standard University of Chicago model just takes prices as a given and assumes that they are kind of opportunity cost neutral. You're going beyond price to say, listen, there's a mechanism by which prices is derived. And then you use that mechanism to highlight when there are flaws in price, which is the one lesson economic folks have a hard time dealing in.
That's right. And here, as you mentioned, I'm drawing on a huge body of mathematical theory that demonstrates exactly how this works. But you don't need to do the math to understand the basic idea that goes right back to Adam Smith, that that when markets work in the way they should, if something is being charged for a price that exceeds its value to other people, to consumers, less of it will be produced, and the market price will adjust. I have a nice quote from Hayek about the price of tin, that somebody who's in the market for tin doesn't, if the price goes up, they don't need to know whether that's because there's a strike in the tin mine on the other side of the world or whether because there's another use for tin. All they need to know is tin is more expensive than it used to be. They should find some way to use less of it to substitute some other material for it, for example. So that's how markets work, and it's an incredibly impressive mechanism. But I guess my book is addressed at least as much to people on the left of politics who distrust markets as the people on the right who have too much faith in them.
And then you do highlight, and I'm sure in a way that they have tried to rebut over the years, that a lot of things from a one lesson economic approach, that is that the market is a reasonable market and market prices are a reasonable, offer a reasonable equilibrium. You point over and over again that the underlying assumptions of a market economy don't take into account certain factors, specifically property rights. And then there's also intellectual property rights and certain other kind of what are perceived to be natural and almost non-economic frameworks. But as you point out, once you look at them, not from a price perspective, but from an opportunity cost perspective, that that they are not neutral. And that the opportunity costs are distorted by whatever the specific property relationships in any given context might well be, and that those are historical factors that people have to take into account.
That's right. And I think intellectual property provides the clearest case because there we can see the property rights being created. If you look at things like land, the history of land goes back a long way, and I have a quote from Hume saying, yeah, at some point, in essence, it was stolen. But in the case of intellectual property, we can actually see rights being taken away from one group of people and given to another. That every time Congress, as has done over many years, extends the term of copyright, that takes away the right of of users to do things like draw pictures of Mickey Mouse, assigns those rights to the Disney Corporation. It takes away the rights of pharmaceutical producers to produce pharmaceutical, gives it to whoever holds the patent or copyright on that pharmaceutical. And so that's something where those property rights are clearly being created in full view. But it's also true that when you change the law regarding what kind of bargaining procedures allow between unions and corporations, both unions and corporations exist in a framework of law. As you change the law, you change the property rights in ways that substantially affect the outcome of things like wage bargaining.
And that wage bargaining or the intellectual property, your point is that with these, again, I might call them externalities, so I think in an for economists, that means something slightly different, but that these externalities explain or begin to explain a lot of why one lesson economics, that is just simple, a market has an answer for everything, why that fails to answer so many questions, and why there are huge distortions periodically, recessions, depressions, market bubbles, et cetera, that really are very poorly explained by an economics in one lesson approach.
That's right. So there's really two things going on here. One is the point that if you ignore the opportunity costs arise when we create property rights, the opportunity cost is essentially creating property rights for one person, takes away choices for other people. What you get is an implicit privileging of certain kinds of property rights, that roughly speaking, the narrow definition of property rights that covers share ownership and covers ownership of corporations, covers ownership of land and things like that, but doesn't include rights to ideas, rights to a job, for example. So that's one part of it. But the other part is, as you say, the whole setup in terms of ensuring that prices match opportunity costs depends on the assumption that the economy is working in such a way that there aren't any free lunches left on the table, there aren't any bargains that could be made and aren't being made. In a recession, that simply isn't true. There are unemployed workers who'd be eager to produce something and people who'd happily consume it, but the market doesn't deliver that outcome. And that's the core idea of macroeconomics. And you know, I invoke Keynes. He was the first person to say this isn't just a random blip which will go away quickly. This can happen and be sustained for very long periods. And we've seen that recently over the last decade, that things are going along fine. The financial crisis comes along and takes years and years and years for full employment to return. Even though we're now much nearer full employment, the people who have jobs now and are working productively were just as capable of doing that 5 years ago when they're unemployed.
And, you know, at a more basic level, and maybe this is a cartoon version, but in the full Chicago model, you don't have booms and busts because a properly working market addresses those things and offsets them fairly quickly, the imbalances that occur. And the history of booms and busts and distortions and high levels of unemployment kind of in very simple terms shows that that simple approach doesn't work. Though I think if Milton Friedman were here, he would say that it is, and this is what's interesting in your second lesson, which is where you begin to make policy proposals, broadly speaking, policy proposals, is that the imperfections of the system are due to the imperfect markets. If we had perfect markets, then we wouldn't have these extremes and we would have closer to full employment, but that it is, you know, the counter argument that it is imperfect markets that lead to imperfect outcomes and perfect markets would lead to perfect outcomes. That's their answer to this. And you're saying, well, you can't get around, you can't get to proper opportunity costs as a driver of good market activity with the current set of whether it's regulation or property rights or regulatory frameworks. I may be incorrectly stating your position, but it becomes a complicated back and forth, regardless.
It does, yeah. In my previous Zombie Economics book, I talked quite a bit about this, and Friedman actually had a more sophisticated position than the Chicago economists who succeed him in the 1980s and 1990s. So Friedman certainly recognized that the economy could be out of whack and stay that way for a long period. He basically said, but don't try and do too much. Just use monetary policy to stabilize the economy. The next generation came up with this idea of real business cycle theory, in which even when it looks as if the economy is in recession, supposedly people are making the right choices. You have a sudden preference for leisure, so it's been derided as the Great Vacation theory of depressions. But that was a kind of desperate attempt to salvage the idea that the equilibrium I'm talking about, where prices match opportunity costs, prevailed at all times. That's kind of been abandoned, but without any real rethinking, I think, of the Chicago position. So you have a situation where Chicago economists can scarcely deny that these recessions are a big problem, but they don't have they've ruled out of court really any possible solution.
One big externality I also want to get to before moving on to another topic is, and it's one that Hazlitt acknowledges, and it's one even that I, working my way through financial history, not as an economist, but more from a finance and investment perspective, a stock market perspective, is pollution. The market solution for pollution is just terrible. There is no market solution for pollution, and and even Hazlitt acknowledged that. And you spend a fair amount of time on the book trying to figure out, you know, what how we can, given that climate change and pollution are now really, really pressing issues for the planet, what is the economic approach to that? And the one lesson crowd doesn't have much to say about it, unfortunately.
No, well, of course, it's not that there isn't a market solution. I think the vast majority of economists outside the narrow one lesson group would agree that if we created the right kinds of property rights and had the right kinds of prices, that would be the best way of solving the problem. That is, that we would have, for example, a system of trade emissions permits. The problem, I think, is that this really would confront the pure one lesson people with the fact that property rights aren't these naturally occurring things. They're something that's created by society to serve social ends. And so rather than admit that point, they've essentially resorted to wishing the problem away by embracing climate science denial. So if climate science, if global warming isn't a problem, then we don't need to create global property rights to fix it. And so that kind of wishful thinking has been the predominant response among one lesson economists, unfortunately. So again, it's not the markets can't work, it's that they can only work in the context of the right kinds of property rights and the right kinds of government policies.
I think in terms from a finance perspective of the right kinds of depreciation charges, maybe that's a little too mechanical, but if you had a proper depreciation charge for carbon, meaning items, the impact onto the economy from carbon heavy activities, many things would be much more expensive than they currently are, flying airplanes and a lot of manufacturing activities. For me, it would just be an accounting issue. You take a full account of the cost to the planet, not just the cash cost of getting the resource. And the world looks very, very different when you have a much, much higher depreciation charge for certain activities. And that would create potentially, and this is my view, not yours, and we'll end it in seconds here, but that would create more of a fair market approach to pollution if things were priced correctly, from my perspective.
No, I agree entirely with that. And the problem is, of course, making companies and users, ultimately, of course, consumers pay that price requires either explicit carbon taxes or pollution permits, and that's proved politically incredibly difficult.
Yeah, and even when purported charge for carbon, I actually have encountered a few times, is really quite low, and I thought unusually low. I'm not certain how well developed carbon charges are, but over time, perhaps that will become more developed. I want to step back just a little bit because I do think it is important for particularly those who had to work their way through economics textbooks, because in addition to answering a very real and present question, or engaging in a debate between sort of the Chicago school, the market always is correct, and the solution to a more nuanced approach through opportunity cost. You actually also provide a nice history of macroeconomics, starting briefly with Adam Smith, but you know, the real history of macroeconomics and the textbooks that are on too many shelves starts with Alfred Marshall in the late 19th and early 20th century. You pick it up with Marshall, Pigou, Keynes. You don't do much with Samuelson because he really approaches things from a different perspective. But then you do go through the 70s, where the up through the 70s, where the Chicago school is dominant, and now you're part of the pendulum swing back. And I like Marshall, and I wonder if we can kind of save Marshall a little bit, and if you could just provide an overview just of that history, so that the students who picked up one textbook realize actually there are a lot of different textbooks, and there are different ways to frame this very important issue of macroeconomics.
Hmm. I talk a lot about Marshall in the context of externalities and the history of the word. I'm obviously fascinated by intellectual history and words and things like that. And Marshall, this idea of externalities comes in originally in the notion of external economies of scale, that if you have a bunch of people producing the same good in a given area, they'll all benefit each other by creating a supply of a network of suppliers and so forth. And that's actually come back. Paul Krugman made his name on that stuff. And then I move on and talk about Marshall's great successor, Keynes, who's very much in the Marshall mould, making the point that all of these things will only work if the economy is operating at full employment, and that can't be automatically guaranteed. And Marshall and Keynes are both very readable. You move on. You mentioned Samuelson, and Samuelson was a great economist, and I admire him very much. And if you want to actually put numbers on the kinds of things that we're talking about, you need to start with a textbook like Samuelson's Foundations and or the various versions of the same thing that have come.
And just for everyone, for those benefits who, you know, so this is 1890 to 1920 is for Marshall.
Yeah.
Keynes is 1934. Samuelson is 1949. And Samuelson comes from a different tradition, a more mechanical tradition. By the way, he's the best writer by far. Keynes is also very good, but Samuelson is in a different league as a writer.
Samuelson writes really well, but I think the crucial thing, Samuelson, not so much coming out of a different tradition, is starting a new one in which mathematical formalization played a key role. And that's valuable, but you don't need it to understand the issues. You need it if you want to, for example, construct economic models to get actual numbers. But to understand the issues, you can really do everything, in my view, with this idea of opportunity cost and prices.
Which is what and that is so accessible compared to a lot of the quantitative finance that I encounter. But the Chicago school becomes dominant for several decades in finance and investments. I've been have had to deal with them as well. And that period's from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and now the pendulum, would you say, is swinging back towards a more balanced approach?
Yeah, so I think economics is driven by crises. So I think Keynes came in the 30s, right in the Great Depression, had an answer which seemed to work for a very long time, right up until the early 1970s. When that broke down, Friedman had a plausible explanation of a lot of it, and we saw the Chicago school, first with Friedman and then with the more extreme versions like real business cycle theory, holding sway again until the global financial crisis, for which they really had no explanation and no answer. And so so now we're, for the last 10 years, the pendulum has been swinging, but also in a sense the profession is sort of out in the wilderness trying to work out what to do with this. There hasn't been a new consensus emerging, rather different groups saying, well, this, what everything proves I was right, but I think the end result has been to very much erode the certitudes of the Chicago school that prices match up with opportunity costs, and that financial markets, however crazy they may seem, do the job they're supposed to in terms of matching the opportunity cost of capital with the available capital, the view that, no, look, some of this just is crazy, I think has a much stronger purchase after 10 years of crisis than it did.
Indeed. And my overlap with your work is greatest in that section where you deal with the efficient market hypothesis and the notion that markets, financial markets are efficient, which is just a sub-example or an example of the broader theory. But the various crises that occur within financial markets and the wild swings in asset pricing have shown that to be not true. But still, everyone's MBA and the CFA program, it's all still it's all still Chicago. It's all still Merton Miller. And, you know, the pendulum, the fight may be going on in the trenches. But in academia, I'm not, you know, you're, this is one of the reasons I was so keen on interviewing you. I don't know where academia stands at this point, but in the popular imagination, the Chicago school still is very predominant.
It's an interesting thing. One of the things that happened around this time in the 1970s was that finance sort of, there was a historical kind of finance that was very institutionally based and didn't really have much theory to it. Finance split off from economics with the efficient markets hypothesis. All the big figures there were econ people, Farmer, and then of course Black Scholes and people like this. They all came out of economics, but then moved into a separate finance discipline. And so I think that the economics profession as a whole has moved very much away from one lesson certitudes, not entirely, but all the interesting ideas in the last 30 years have been about reasons why that doesn't work, whereas I think finance has more dug into the technicalities of for example, the capital asset pricing model and its various evolutions, because, of course, there's a huge amount of money to be made in getting those models to work a little bit better than the next person's model. So you do have this divide in academia, I think, now between economics and finance.
Within finance, so I will just shout out the behavioral finance people are making headway, and that's to be applauded. Let's shift to sort of the second part of your book, where you're moving towards, and you specifically say you're not trying to promote a policy agenda, but you sort of are, because you do. You do, and you're raising some key issues. Not just they are the key ones that are discussed throughout the book. They involve full levels of unemployment or levels of unemployment. They involve income inequality and mechanisms to adjust it, and they also deal with pollution, among other things. And you are advocating the externalities that would, and correct me if I'm wrong if I rephrase this, but supporting externalities that would offset and kind of level the playing field against those natural externalities, property rights, intellectual property rights, that have distorted opportunity costs. And you want to provide kind of a pendulum or a counterbalance to those externalities with your own that would make opportunity cost a better and more effective tool. Is that a fair overview?
Yeah. I mean, I challenge the view that these things are natural, but they are what we have. And so, what I'd say—
Inherited, perhaps inherited.
I suppose I certainly obviously have a policy agenda. I'm more saying in this book, I want to set the scene for people to think about things rather than lay out specific policies. I want to say this is how we should think about these issues. So I hope in thinking about it, people will come up with ideas that are kind of similar to mine. But the book doesn't set out much in the way of saying, this is the 10-point plan you should follow. It says, this is the way you should think about these issues.
Well, a couple of the issues are minimum wage and unions to deal with issues of employment. Do you want to, explain how, because again, in the U.S., minimum wage legislation and unionization or union pro against union has become, unfortunately, almost not economic, but highly, highly politicized. You're at least making mostly, if not entirely, economic arguments about the pros and the cons of these. Do you want to kind of highlight those?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start by saying, of course, I'm writing for a U.S. audience, and the U.S. is the big, important economy in the world, especially because I can't make head or tail of the Chinese economy, so I never say anything about that. But in this context, being an Australian gives you a different perspective. Australia has the highest minimum wage in the world in real terms, and yet our labour market in most respects looks very like the US, very similar rates of unemployment, very similar patterns in terms of it's certainly true that, of course, less educated workers have higher unemployment rates, but we don't have any of the effects that a lot of people in the US debate would anticipate from having a high minimum wage. And so that, I suppose, frames my thinking quite a bit. What I look at is the question of what effect the minimum wage is going to have on the market distribution of income. So part of the story is one tendency in the period in which the Chicago School was dominant, what you might call the third wave, was to say, look, let the market rip, but then we'll redistribute everything through taxes and social welfare and it'll be all right. What's being pushed here is, no, the distribution of income you get coming out of the market, coming out of the labour market, for example, is just as important as what you do with taxes and transfers to redistribute that. And so the evidence, as I read it, is that a high minimum wage in total will in fact benefit workers at the low end of the scale, that the evidence seems to be that a substantial part of the downward pressure on wages comes from the fact that workers don't have the unlimited freedom to move between jobs that's implied in the Chicago model, and that employers do have a substantial power to hold wages down. Of course, standard economics, whenever anybody has the power to lower the price they pay and increase the prices that they charge, they'll use that power.
Has that, you know, again, I just not to challenge you on every point, but, you know, in a manufacturing economy, the imbalance in power between labor and capital is clear. In the service economy, it's a little less clear. And the gig economy, it's very less clear because labor is fairly mobile. As a historian, I would highlight that classic distinction between labor and capital should have a historical element to it, that it was a lot worse at an earlier time, shall we say. I don't know how that figures in.
I would actually turn that around. I mean, I think in US context particularly, for historical reasons, yeah, the high point of US manufacturing also coincided with the high point of the American Union movement. You had this situation coming out of World War II where the US manufacturing sector was so far advanced ahead of everybody else that they could charge high prices globally and receive them. And at the same time, labor was very strong and got high wages. So you had this situation where manufacturing workers could earn a middle-class income, not because there's anything special about manufacturing or the work they did, but because of the economic circumstance at the time. Whereas the gig economy really turns those things around. The number of platforms available for gig workers compared to the number of workers potentially able to work is a huge imbalance of power. So really what you see is that the absence of secure conditions for gig workers, I think, has contributed significantly to the stagnation of wages that we've seen in the US and in Australia, in Australia for the last 10 years, maybe in the US really for the last 40 years.
And technology, you don't really address the role of technology and productivity gains as contributing to that, a nominal deflation. It's not really part of what you're trying.
I don't talk about it in this book, but I do talk about it a lot. And my view is, there's always an interaction between technology and the social and economic conditions, property rights, and so forth. The manufacturing high wage equilibrium the US had depended on, of course, the availability of that manufacturing technology, but also on the social condition that produced powerful unions. When you have technological disruption, that's going to favour whoever has the most power. And so in the US current environment, in the US and in Australia, workers really and unions been pushed backwards. But as long as things are stable, employers may choose not to take on a fight. But when you disrupt things, when you break up the existing arrangements, what emerges is going to be to the benefit of whichever group has the power at the time. And in the context of the US and Australia, that's very much employers as opposed to workers. So I think this disruptive effect of technology doesn't have a predictable direction. In other circumstances, the creation of the US manufacturing sector and all the disruption that went on with that, sit-down strikes and so forth, produced the high-wage economy of the 50s and 60s. The disruption of the digital economy has produced the low-wage gig economy.
Let's move on to another hot-button issue, tax rates, income distribution. You do spend a lot of time pointing out that, income inequality is, and this may be a debatable point depending on one's kind of fundamental precepts about how one approaches society and levels of equality. And, you do again point out that significant inequality is, correct me if I'm wrong, is yet another view that of the externalities that you would perhaps adjust on the other side with a marginal tax rate and, taxing what the top 1% should be taxed and so forth. Do you want to touch on that again? Because it is such a hot button issue.
Sure. Yeah. So I want to, again, address this with this notion of opportunity cost, that if, for example, you cut the top marginal tax rate, as we in Australia have just done, that produces, of course, an increase in post-tax income immediately for high-income earners. The opportunity cost is what you could have done with the tax revenue, less what leaks along the way. I mean, if you take money from one person and give it to another, some of it is going to be lost. The person who's paying the taxes will employ lawyers to reduce what they pay, and, of course, some of it will be lost in the costs of paying it to other people. You can do those numbers, and then the question is, well, what is the social value of this choice? Is it worth taking $1,000 off somebody in the top 1% to give $900, $500, $100 to a poor person? That's a choice that has to be made, and that's where the opportunity cost issue comes in, and where economists don't have much more expertise than anybody else. Everybody has to make those choices. But what I suggest is, roughly speaking, an idea of proportional change in income. That if we cut the income of the top 1% of the top rich people by say 10%, and increase the income of the poor by 20%, that would be an improvement in welfare. When you do that kind of number, you come up with estimates that the optimal top marginal tax rate should be something like 70%. And the math behind that is complicated, but it's all there in the journals, and so that's the kind of reasoning you get, that you want to have those tax rates. Not so much, of course, that you end up tipping over the Laffer curve into the area where income actually falls, but enough that you can redistribute income, market income, from those who've gained from the existing arrangement, which, of course, for example, the huge money being made in the finance sector simply wasn't possible without the legal changes of the 70s and 80s to those who've lost out.
That being said, and even acknowledged, it is still just an exceptionally controversial argument.
Absolutely.
In the current, it might not have been 10 years ago, but it is certainly now. Monopoly, mixed economy, level of regulation, shifts from monopoly manufacturers, which we're all taught in school, to monopsony, which is, what we're looking at more and more now in terms of how markets work with very, very large buyers as opposed to very, very large sellers. That, again, you're trying to strike the right balance of regulation and getting the right mixed economy, but it's a mixed economy. It's not that the market is always the right answer.
No, and I guess a large part of the book, and I suppose my program generally, is rehabilitating this idea of the mixed economy that was taken for granted pretty much in the 50s and 60s, whereas the idea of the the ideas of say, the last decades of last century was markets and everything, that we can find a market solution for every problem. I think the evidence is that that's not the case. Equally, of course, although I don't need to spend much time doing it, the second half of the 20th century wasn't at all kind to the idea of central planning. And so so that's an idea, you know, when we talk about the mixture, one pole central planning, I think, has been completely discredited. But it's important to recognise the other pole of a totally market-driven society also isn't going to be.
And then you end on something that is just so very timely and important now, and is open debate. And I would hope that it's not political, but it's become political in this country. But again, trying to figure out a good economic approach to environmental policy, given the challenges the whole planet is facing. And there again, it is not a pure market approach. I mean, do you want to provide some of the highlights of what you think?
Sure. Well, it's an interesting thing because it's an area where, you know, when I started, it's a major concern of mine. When I started 20 years ago looking at this, people on the left in the environmental movement were very keen on what might be called command and control approaches, that you should do this and you shouldn't do that. And there are still some people doing that, you know, at an individual level, saying you should not eat meat, or you should do something. But most people in the environmental movement and on the social democratic left turned to the idea of changing property rights and then using markets, using emissions trading, using taxes. Those ideas actually came out of the more sophisticated part of the Chicago School, but now have been almost entirely rejected on the political right. And so we're being pushed back to things which have broad appeal, which are command and control kinds of things, of mandates for renewables and so forth. That's not the most effective way of reducing emissions. It's something I've struggled with for a long time in terms of what kind of things you should advocate. The difficulty of persuading people who ought to believe in markets that if we'd only change property rights correctly, we would have a market solution.
Or depreciation charges correctly, accounting correctly.
And I spent a bit of time explaining why those two things are essentially the same. Why, if we had the right property rights, the depreciation charges, depreciation on that property would appear in
your
account.
Yes, they should. Well, is there anything else you want to make sure that we haven't covered that you want to make sure comes out in this, and that the readers understand that we haven't covered?
I think just to repeat that the idea of this book is, you know, as the title, The Promise, says. I mean, it's one of those things like The Secret and the Rules that says here's the answers. It doesn't make you an economist. What it does is give you the crucial ideas you need to understand. If you really want to say, well, okay, I get the idea, for example, of a carbon price, but should it be $20 a ton or $200? For that, you need the kind of training that an economics degree gives you. But if you simply want to understand the logic, I really believe this book will tell you nearly everything you need to know.
I do not disagree. The book is Economics in Two Lessons by John Quiggin. It's Why Markets Work So Well and Why They Can Fail So Badly. And it does exactly for people who don't have the at their stage in their life or their career, the time to go back and do all the math of economics, but want to understand intelligently the debates and some of the key issues facing both policymakers, politicians to some extent, in modern macroeconomics. I highly recommend the book. It is I wouldn't call it an easy read, but it's certainly easier, much, much easier than an economics textbook. It is rendered in words and very well written. So, John Quiggin, thank you so much.
Thank you.